Moolala is brought to you by the nonprofit credit counseling agency, Credit Canada. We have talked about RESPs on this show a lot. I'm a huge believer in RESPs. There's a guaranteed good time because of the government grant. I have a kid of my own. I've been doing it since they were born. And it matters how you actually take advantage of this government program. Not all RESPs are created equally. And so we're going to talk about that today. And the catalyst was a listener email talking about a not great experience that he had with something called a scholarship trust. So we're going to take a closer look at what those scholarship trusts are and some of the pros and cons. Our guest is Aravind Sitham Parapile. He is an associate at Ironwood Wealth Management, and he joins us now from Hamilton, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you doing today?
You have skin in the game. Three kids, is that right?
Yep, 7, 5, and 3. So okay. Living it.
You are in it. So as I said, RESPs, there's a government grant. It's a guaranteed 20% return. You can open one up almost anywhere, a bank, a credit union, a brokerage house, a discount brokerage, or you can set up something called a scholarship trust. Take us through exactly what a scholarship trust is.
Love it. Thank you. So a scholarship trust, or they are also called group RESPs, and as the group name implies, what happens is your money. So if I enrolled one of my kids into a scholarship trust, it's not just an RESP for my child. It's a group RESP for a whole bunch of people's children. And so, Bruce, your child might be in there. Many of your listeners, well, one of your listeners is in there. And so all of that money is pooled together. And then the responsibility of managing or growing that pool of contributions is outsourced to this firm, this scholarship trust organization. And then they make the investment decisions on behalf of everyone who's contributed into it. You contribute.
In theory, it sounds great. It's like, yep. Oh my God, that's like insurance. That's like a mutual fund. And it's not so great. There are some cons. Tell us about some of the cons when it comes to these trusts.
So the first thing is everybody's a little different. And I'm sure you've talked about this on your program before. Everyone has different, you know, risk appetites, goals, et cetera. And so lumping everyone in together for something that everyone may have a bit of a different goal or overview for, it doesn't really make sense. Scholarship trusts or group RESPs are very, very conservative in nature. And that's one key example. All of your contributions and government grants go in, and they're typically invested in predominantly only fixed income or bonds. Yeah. And so for someone who has a long time horizon and wants to take some more risk to grow their money, this may not work for them.
If we just put a dollar value on this, and we'll use simple numbers here, you could say that the long-term performance of the markets is, I don't know what number you use, say 5 to 7%, something like that. Yep. And over the last decade, the long-term performance for a GIC, for example, would be, call it 2 to 3. So you're already starting out with a significant gap in anticipated returns just because you haven't, you don't have a diversified portfolio, right?
Nailed it.
Well, there you go. All right. Maybe I should do this. So the first thing is the conservative nature of the investments. Another knock that I hear a lot from listeners on the trusts is the constraints. Like with a traditional RESP that's self-directed, you can put it in anything. You can take it out. You can add it in. Like there's a lot of freedom. Not so with the trusts.
Yep. It's essentially like a contractual obligation, and the assumptions they make and so on, that if you read the prospectus, it goes into detail. But when you opt into one of these, you are not really opting into just opening an RESP. You are opting into making those payments over the entire duration that your child is enrolled, which is basically from birth until they go to post-secondary, which makes no account for what if I lose my job? What if you're dual income household, but one of you passes away and now there's financial constraints. It doesn't really make any consideration for all of the life things that happen across the way.
And, you know, I can see how if you were to flip that the other way, you'd say, great, that's forced savings. It's like a mortgage in that way. It's forced savings. You got to pay that amount every month. But the challenge is, in order of priority, it's more important that you pay your mortgage and put food on your table then save for a kid's education, as important as that is. Is that fair?
It is. And there's actually a little, now Every group RESP or scholarship trust is a little different, but in some of the prospectuses that I've reviewed, I can tell you that they actually charge you interest on those contributions not made.
Right, right. So the third knock that people talk about, and this is what the listener pointed out, is the cost. So he had put in a total of 34 grand of his money, excluding the government contribution. And he asked what that amount would be worth if he were to withdraw it. And he'd been in it for, say, a decade. So you'd assume there was some appreciation, even in a GIC. And he was told that the number he'd get back would not be 34. It would be 27 grand because of the cost to administer those funds. How transparent are the trusts in terms of what those fees are? Because with any financial planner or a mutual fund, it's pretty easy to tell the price you're going to pay.
So it's buried in there. But I would say, based on conversations I've had with clients who've been introduced to a scholarship trust, based on stories I've heard from other people, or clients who have come to me from a scholarship trust, it's not transparent enough because there is an upfront fee. So I believe in the listener letter, they also denoted that in the first 2 years they contributed and had almost nothing left over. And the reason is there is a commission that's charged and your money goes towards paying half of that commission first entirely. So for that first year, they weren't even investing. They were just paying the commission with those contributions. And then there's a fee to administer on top of that.
Now, part of the challenge here, I think there are two others that I would flag. One is that, I don't know if this is safe to say for all of them, but many of them are positioned as nonprofits. As you look at the prospectuses, am I right? Is that how they're positioned structurally?
Structurally, they are positioned that way. It's just that I think, like anything, if you pay enough away in to other people in fees or salaries or things like that, you can still run a nonprofit by having paid everybody else too much money at the cost of the funds themselves.
Right. The other part is they have very effective marketing connected to births, right? So I used to work on Pampers diapers. We did a lot of work trying to target new parents as soon as that kid was born. They are also very focused on entry point marketing, more so maybe than the banks or the credit unions who have these lower cost, you know, more diversified type products.
And not only is the marketing focused on, I know your listeners said, you know, hospitals, but as an example, someone talked about signing up for maternity clothing, like a nursing bra. And, you know, they opt into the loyalty program. And then all of a sudden they got a call. The call was because the scholarship trust had access to that maternity clothing store's subscriber list. If you go to any of these light shows, fairs, you see that scholarship trust, you know, sign up to maybe win $50,000. That's opt-in marketing right there. So there's a handful of ways that they're active that you would not typically realize.
I feel particularly concerned, and I don't know if this is a fair concern for me to have, but I feel particularly concerned for newcomers to Canada, because when you look at it, I mean, certainly the government grant is super compelling, saving for your kids' education. It's compelling for everybody, but particularly, I think, people who are new to Canada because they're, you know, starting afresh in some ways. How do you interpret those, the marketing focus and the demographic target?
So as someone who's been marketed to, like I've had these conversations with scholarship trust employees when I was trying to figure out RESPs for my children, it's very effective because it's positioned as, well, everyone is doing it. Don't you care about your children? Don't you care about giving them their best foot forward? And many immigrants are very education focused. My parents are immigrants. Education was a big priority in our family. And so right away, for many of those people, it's going to tug on the heartstrings. And when you're sleep deprived as a new parent, combined with the emotional piece, it's a very deadly combination.
If I were to have, and we will have, leaders of scholarship trusts on, I'm ambivalent about it because I think there are pros and cons, but if I were to have them there, what would they tell me to rebut the flags or concerns that we have already outlined?
Well, one is those fees, those commissions up front. If you last all the way through, which not everyone does, right? People choose to leave or they withdraw. If you last all the way through, you get a portion of those fees rebated back to you in the form of a bonus. So that is one way that they often equalize for some of these lost returns or higher fees up front that we talk about. Now, what I would point out as someone who cares about the collective good is those fees are basically the fees of the other people who didn't make it through the program. So in a way, I'm making that money off of the backs of these people who lost their job or couldn't contribute at the right time. And many of these prospectuses will even go as far as showing the stats of saying, well, historically, typically 11% don't make it through the program or 20% right. don't make it through. So it's all openly there.
Right. It's a good reminder that with another self-directed RESP, it's super easy to catch up. You can go pick up a year that you've missed up to a max. You can still qualify for that government grant. Okay. Just before we go, we've had all these knocks against the scholarship trust. I think we're aligned on our belief that a self-directed option is better. How does one do that simply? You can do it as soon as you've got the social insurance number of the kid immediately.
Yep. And like you already talked about in the beginning, banks, credit unions, brokerages, or if you have, you know, an advisor who works with a custodian and can facilitate it at one of the independent firms, you go to them or you do it yourself. You put in the SIN number, you put in the birth certificate, and you open it, and you can choose or get someone to help you choose any of the public investments available out there for you to choose from. Yeah. And then it's contributing as much or as little as fits within your financial plan.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we will say the 20% government grant tops out at $500. It's not going to be $10,000 a year. It tops out, but it is really simple to do in a low cost and diversified way. Thank you for your time and for having this conversation with us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Our topic was scholarship trusts. I'm a big believer in RESPs. Really, really, really. There's just cheaper, simpler, more flexible ways to do it other than the scholarship trusts. Our guest was Aravind Sitham Parapile. He is an associate at Ironwood Wealth Management.